Okay, the first question I pulled out. Can you tell us about how Ajahn Chah taught Western monks when he doesn't know English? Because I did mention it, that image of the water and how you know with the language you... hard to tell water, but that is one of the ways that he himself answered when people asked. I remember another time when he was asked how he taught Westerners when he didn't know English, and he said, "It's not difficult, just like teaching buffaloes." Pull them here, pull them there, and sooner or later they learn. So comparing sort of Westerners to water buffaloes, the principle under both of those is really in the sense of both in terms of experience and training, because what Ajahn Chah taught was very much around training, and in as opposed to philosophy. He didn't really teach us about the philosophy of Buddhism, although we learned it by being steeped in it. But it was more the experience of training and practicing and living it, and so that he really. His example and the conditions that he set. Also, he was extremely capable. He was an incredible communicator, so that even with simple language, he could really communicate. I remember one time a particular monk there's a group of us, and then Ajahn Chah came over to visit, and this monk had been a monk for a few years, and then his language wasn't even though it was, still wasn't that good. But anyway, we came out to receive him, and he came up to that monk, and then he just sort of went up and put his hand on his chest and sort of felt like he was still hot. So it was. He really understood people's character, and was able to, you know, to make it light as well. So that was, he was really, skilled communicator. If this question is okay, could you please tell us any more about how Ajahn Chah challenged you in those first 5 years and or later? I remember one hot season where I was there and really wanting to be somewhere else, and I'd ask and he would find something else for me to do, find something, and there was always, I just had to give up. I wanted to escape, and it was all of the really good, logical, practical reasons that I kept coming up with weren't working, and he just wouldn't. Give me an inch of indulge that, so that I just had to stay and stick it out through the hot season. And he He also had me working, cleaning the insides of water tanks in the hot season. It was just the most miserable job. So, yeah, that's memorable. Okay, I'm trying to be with the breath without controlling it. When I let go of control, the breath seems to accelerate so that I can't keep up with it. Help. I think sometimes, a sense of balance is really important, because if for some reason there's a, so like the breath is accelerating and both the mind is having a hard time keeping up, maybe the body is agitated because of that, then to be consciously finding ways, and it isn't sort of controlling in terms of trying to make it submit to one's will sort of thing, but the finding ways that one can direct attention that helps that relaxation and settling, so that breathing with the whole body, or really allowing allow the breath to extend into the places of the body where one because normally, of course, if we think of it in a rational way anatomical, then the breath just sort of comes in your lungs and goes out again. But that isn't how you experience it. It isn't how you feel it. So that you can be, and when we speak of the breath, it's also kind of the breath energy, or the body energy, or the life energy. Like when we do the precepts, the first precepts, panatipata velamini, I determine the precept to not take the life of any living creature. Well, any living creature is pana, and it's the same as anapana. Sati. Ana is the in-breath, pana is the breath is it. So that it's the breath. So then it's this is the kind of the life force. So that attending to that breath energy, attending to that, the kind of the living body being that's infused with the breath, and then allowing that to settle, breathing into the body, letting the body breathe out, finding ways to relax and soothe and settle, and of course there's a directing of energy and directing of attention and framing how we experience it, which you might call it controlling, but one needs to be able to learn how to play with the breath and play with attention in different ways, so that the meditation becomes both alive as well as easeful, and the mind has an opportunity to become clear and settled. Is it okay to do standing meditation here during a meditation session when nothing else is working for sleepiness or restlessness? I think that's fine. The standing, because I think the when the meditation, say, what is the point of meditation? Well, the point of meditation is not just to say to sit, but it's to develop and mindfulness and alertness with clear comprehension, so that the ways that we can accomplish that, sometimes the that using standing meditation is a very good alternative for especially dispelling drowsiness, and certainly sometimes for restlessness. One of the monasteries that I lived in, in my first year as a monk, the routine actually was like the evening meeting. It was an hour of walking meditation, an hour of standing meditation, an hour of sitting meditation. That was the evening meeting. So that and standing meditation formed a part of pretty much everybody's practice. So that standing meditation is very useful. I mean, it is harder to fall asleep standing up, which is good. I've done it. In the chants of fusion with divine abidings, what does it mean? I will abide pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with loving kindness, compassion, etc. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. Why does it not say something like pervading the entire heart? This is when we say one quarter, it's meaning a directional, so that north, south, east, west, sort of like a fusion of divine abidings permeating out from one. That's how that is, what that chant is pointing to, or and that's what it's meaning, and that's how it's used, so that one is holding a point, and then one is using that as a directional ascending forth of these divine abidings and these well wishes, good wishes. Okay, thank you for the teachings. While I've been developing an understanding of the mind, I'm wondering if you could speak about the heart or body, which appear to be words used interchangeably. How can we listen with discernment to the heart? How can we cultivate its strength? Thank you for your consideration. Well, I think one of the things is that particularly that division between mind, heart, in the English language, that doesn't exist in Buddhist the Buddhist teachings, or how the Buddha's conception of the mind, of the heart. These are in the English language, we tend to separate them, and but the the experience of feeling, emotion, cognition, analysis, discernment, those are all one whole, its strength, of course, comes from awareness and that quality of being able to know and see and experience these different facets of experience clearly. The body, of course, is a, the physical container of and that we rely on for our sense bases and the experience of kind of the life force is part of the physical processes dependent on the elements of nature, so that they're, of course, they function together, and sometimes in my own expression of things, I do try to put, try to encourage people to ground experience in a bodily awareness, because there tends to be, I think, a helpful anchor when we have something as solid and stable as the body to sustain attention or anchor attention. You know, our emotions pull us in different directions. And sometimes it's hard to keep up. So then having the awareness of the body to return to and provide a continuity of attention and awareness so that we can see more clearly, I find that helpful. And of course, when it gets to thoughts, then they're usually a lot quicker and faster than so that having the body as a touch point is, I find, very helpful. But this aspect of you know, cultivation of its strength, it all comes back to that continuity of attention and awareness as we become more consistent with that. Qualities of you know, being attentive, alert, present, the mind becomes more internally settled and clear. Was metta taught as a concentration earlier than Buddhaghosa? Also, how is it taught in the Thai forest tradition now? Metta was certainly taught as a meditation before Buddhaghosa. It was taught by the Buddha during the time of the Buddha and in subsequent centuries after that as a part of the toolkit of practice in the Buddha's teachings. Buddhaghosa was a commentator who compiled the old commentaries, codified them, brought them together. But they were these were teachings and trainings that had been taught and then developed in different ways. All the different little techniques and nuances are from commentaries that pre-existed Buddhaghosa's time. Buddhaghosa wrote the Path to Purification is kind of a manual for practice, but then the commentaries to the suttas and whatnot, that's like almost 1,500 years after the Buddha passed away, or 1,000 years, something like that. So it's a long time after the Buddha passed away, but those are taking the, I think it's about 1,000 years, and then but it was taking what was already existing, and then compiling it and bringing it all together. In the Thai forest tradition, there, one is to sort of say the Thai, to assume somehow that the Thai forest tradition is a kind of entity that has some kind of consistent party line. It doesn't exist like that. It's really the in Thailand, you've got monasteries all over. You got 30,000 monasteries through the country, and the forest tradition comprises, you know, a small portion of that, and within that, it's very idiosyncratic, and you know, people tend to teach what has been helpful for them, and they'll pick up stuff here and there, and they'll try this out and try that. Thais are extremely practical people, so that. And when it comes to the monastics, it's not a kind of a doctrinal positions aren't held very firmly at all, and tend to be looking for ways that help, so that the a metta practice in some way, shape, or form, they'll take it on and use it, and it's usually, you know, somewhat based on the existing traditions, but they'll try this out, try that out. I think that's where you get a sense of a living tradition, to me it's a breath of fresh air, as opposed to you've got this kind of doctrinal position that you've got to hold, and that doesn't really fit in Thailand very well. Okay, this is more an appreciation than a question. Dear Ajahn Krunadhammo, it certainly takes a lot of ink to write out your name. Your talk today was incredibly timely. You described exactly what I was mulling over this afternoon and wondering if there was a way to ask if this was a correct way to proceed. Thank you. So,
yeah. I don't know,
my name. Blame him. Okay, this is another appreciation. Thank you all for the abundant, exalted, immeasurable gratitude that I'm presently experiencing, as streaming out of my jitta and headed right toward you. Don't duck. In the article Consciousness by Ajahn Lee, he talks about beings that inhabit the mind and body. For example, a thought in your mind could be the thought of a separate being or consciousness. Illnesses are also possibly caused by such beings. What are your thoughts on this? When seeing unusual phenomena that can be interpreted in this way, what is a good course of action? Much gratitude. I haven't read that, so I'm not familiar with it. It's not it's certainly not how it usually falls into our worldview. But whatever the, when you say whatever, the, whether the, whatever the case, the good course of action is always virtue, concentration, wisdom, Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, and relinquishing unwholesome mental states, developing wholesome mental states. It doesn't stray from that foundation. So that, and that's when, say, for, say, certainly in Thailand, that wouldn't be a strange way of perceiving. But still, the forest teachers always emphasize that aspect of returning to the refuge of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, cultivation of the path, penetration of the Four Noble Truths. That's your fundamental foundation that holds you in good stead, whatever the sort of the world view, because this is a bit more of a kind of moving into mystical realms and all sorts of different realms of different beings and different planes of existence. You know, that foundation is still the same. One could move into a highly psychologized kind of approach. You've still got this basic foundation that really works for the overcoming of suffering and freedom from the things that create suffering. Would you please describe the four ways of skillfully answering or asking questions, or the different types of questions? I would love to do it if I could remember it. I could only vaguely do it justice. Any backup? Because there's questions that are answered categorically, analytically. So that for some questions, one gives a categorical answer. I mean, it's a yes or no. You would say very clear. One you have to analyze. There's a counter question, and then there's a disregarding of the question, because the question is there's no way to actually give a proper question, because the assumption of the question is not in accord with Dhamma. In homage to the Sangha chant, what are the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings? This is always a mystery, isn't it? Four pairs are the. It's the way it's divided in the pairs of beings, or those beings who are on the path of liberation or of the enlightenment, and those who have experienced the fruits of that. So then, those are pairs, so the path and fruit, and then the four kinds are the stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, arahant. So those are the four levels of liberation, of enlightenment. So that's how it gets its four pairs, eight kinds of noble beings. It makes sense that loving kindness is the antidote to a person directed ill will. But what is the antidote to a more recurring, low-level, general aversion to experience? One could make a case for loving-kindness being having a global effect in the sense of both in terms of a person-directed ill will, but also a low-level general aversion to experience. Because in order to, say, direct it to a person, then you actually have to arouse that mental state within you. So that as you arouse that mental state of loving-kindness, and you say experience it, inhabit it, it changes your consciousness. It changes your heart. It isn't that you just sort of you send that loving-kindness out and there's none left for you. It isn't something that's lost. It's something that you generate, steep the heart in those thoughts and feelings of loving kindness, and then that is what is directed externally. I think again, this is where sometimes language or idioms that we use sometimes create assumptions, so that we're sending forth of loving kindness. So we send it out. It's person directed. I think one of the more skillful ways of cultivating loving kindness is not that one is, sort of sending it here and sending it there, sort of the loving kindness mailman sort of thing, but the envisioning as one cultivates loving kindness to envision the heart as a vessel that one is then imbuing with loving kindness. And as one establishes that base of this vessel, the heart of loving kindness, as it becomes stronger, rather than sending loving kindness, you're inviting beings into that sphere of loving kindness. And you can, as you establish that a base of loving kindness within the heart, that can become more expansive, and it can grow, and it can encompass more beings, and you can invite more beings into that space until it becomes boundless. But the base is always the heart itself, what I've used is just like an envisioning of a vessel we're filling it with loving kindness, and then allowing it to grow. So that's I found that more a useful image rather than the sending forth, because then it becomes finite, the whole purpose of the the loving kindness practices are they're all one of their they're called divine abidings, but they're also called the apamanya, which are boundless, so not bounded by there's no boundaries to it, so that expansive. Aha. Where are the Baramis listed and described in the Pali Canon? They actually aren't. So that they're, this is a, the Buddha pointed to different, the Baramis are a post-canonical category of the teachings. Very, very early. Like in the earliest layers of the post-canonical literature, like probably within 100, 200 years after the, but it that's when there's these, and then they went back and looked at what were the qualities that the Buddha was pointing to, and I can't remember the actual text where the where the Baramis are first listed. That's where it's handy to have a. There's a particular Buddhist dictionary that I use from the Thai language that really gives all the source material. But it's a very old text, but it's and is a very important category of how they that development of the cultivation of the Baramis. So that to find it easily, then that would be in the Visuddhimagga, path of purification. That would that'd be easy to find there. What would you say to someone who committed suicide, if you could, before or after? You know, certainly I'd say, you know, before, that don't do it. I never So, but I think there's interviews of people who like jump from the Golden Gate Bridge to commit suicide and weren't successful, and that's kind of the first thought that went through their minds. You know, what the heck was I thinking of? And I think for many people that just the level of despair is so overwhelming that I think one of the things to be somebody who is to somebody who's contemplating suicide. That one really tries to convey the degree of concern and care and love that one has for them, because I think that's one of the things that people feel so. Sometimes end up in a place where they feel so alienated and separated from themselves and the world around them that it seems like a good option, but it is as a certainly for in Buddhist conception of things then. Suicide is taking say, vibhava tanha, the desire for non-being, non-becoming to its kind of extreme conclusion, and that is a source of suffering that carries on into the that conditions the next existence, which will be most likely be quite painful. Somebody who has committed suicide, I think it is important that one does ceremony or ritual or offerings and dedications of blessings in their memory, holding their memory and their in one's thoughts, because it's say if there is the possibility of that transference of merit, then that's of some benefit. And then, even if there isn't, it's still a good thing to do for oneself. So. Okay, why does the chanting book begin with the evening chants first? I have no idea. I really don't know. Ajahn Amaro. Pin it on Ajahn Amaro. Is there anything in the scriptures, teachings, that would relate to the idea of organ donation? There's nothing overt in the scriptures, in the teachings that that I can think of that would relate to that. But I think it's in the Buddhist world there is, or particularly in Theravada world, there is a that's an easy. It's easy for them to get their mind around it and think that that's a really good thing. I mean, in terms of dana, especially in the Thai tradition, that sense of dana, generosity, it's a virtue of value. They put a high value on that. So then, the idea of actually donating one's organs from one's body to be a benefit to somebody else, to help them to support somebody else's life, that's something that is certainly not shied away from or is considered something quite meritorious. Also with the, because there isn't a sacredness to the body in the same way that there is certainly in Christian tradition, and I don't know enough about Islamic tradition, but I think there is certainly in Christian tradition where you want to have your body intact, because when you're resurrected, then you want to be missing bits. You know, organ donor. Yeah, I don't want to call it.
So
the organ donation would be considered really meritorious. The last question, sort of, after your 17 talks on Anapanasati, were you out of breath? There's probably still more to say. And actually, somebody came down from the monastery today, and they brought some of those Anapanasati CDs, so that there's some that were sent down. So they'll be out on the last day. And if there aren't enough to go around, then you can sort of find somebody to share with or.
It's online.
It is online. Really?
Well, not on your
website. That's so pathetic. Sometimes our website is so. I mean, in some ways it's very beautiful and nicely done. Sometimes it's missing bits. Okay. On Birkin's website. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Okay. Ajahn Son is up to speed with stuff like that. He's the first person. He had this. What did he call it? This was years ago. And the technology was still, but he had all the audio stuff on a kind of computer hard drive that people could download and listen to, and it would be out. So there's a computer which you couldn't actually access the internet or do anything else on. You could just get Dhamma from, and it's still there. And it's called the Dhammatron. Not 100% sure of the question for this. Writing, but I'll see what I think I've got the gist. Are there any times or situations for whom formal practice is not particularly helpful? If so, please, sort of asking for something about alternative practices. So, there's sometimes, even in our own ourselves, I mean, there's sometimes when formal practice is very difficult. Could be there's a lot of stress or there's a lot of distraction in some way, and it's really hard to do the formal practice, and that's where having a good spiritual friendship is helpful in that, because sometimes if it's difficult for ourselves, but then to be in a group and doing something together with others, then we can get some momentum going, and that's very, very helpful. Sometimes, for ourselves, we might find formal sitting difficult, but then walking meditation is more useful or meaningful. Or sometimes, like for chanting, is something that can be very useful for people. Not so much for, oftentimes for us as Westerners, sometimes we don't connect with chanting. It took me a while to connect with chanting, but that's a, you know, in traditional Buddhist cultures, and chanting forms a large part of ways of skillful means of being able to settle, focus attention. And I personally, I found my mind become very settled and peaceful chanting. And so those are helpful practices. Sometimes, just say for myself, I can remember times when, you know, it's just really difficult to sit or get energy going at all, and just picking up a broom and sweeping the trails in the monastery, just really, and in making that a practice, just having being able to have a physical activity that I could engage in, and that could be the same if one, you know, incredibly restless. Okay, something to put energy into that. If one's just, there's this restless energy, and every time you try to sit, then it's like, you know, there's ants crawling in one's skin. It's just finding something that one can be putting energy into. That's not. It's not distracting. It's actually a benefit to others as well. Or like if as a householder. I mean, some people have gardening. Gardening is a great way of focusing attention and doing something that is settling. So there's many things that one can be doing for oneself. And I think in terms of some people where formal meditation is not so helpful, certainly sometimes with mental illness, schizophrenia in particular, that should be really carefully either supported or being very careful with, because there's a kind of evangelical Buddhist meditators, sort of, it's a panacea for everything, and it's not. It needs to be really skillfully advised and monitored, so that for some mental illnesses, then you really want to be very careful and being so that evangelical zeal needs to be curbed, and one has to be very incredibly kind and wise actually in one's advice. So that with some people, you can't just sort of say, "Oh, you should go and meditate," because it might not be the best thing at all. There are some people who are obsessive meditators. It'd be good to just get them to actually do something. Mm-hmm. It'd be better for them sometimes. So that's. Again, this aspect of balance is such an important a quality you should be attending to in terms of just because something is good doesn't mean it's always good. Mm-hmm. You can have too much of a good thing, or you can have a good thing that isn't used in the right way. So that these tools and techniques and teachings that the Buddha has given us, one has to have some experience and wisdom in order to apply them. You can see that just for yourself. You know, how much do we fumble around with ourselves, and then in terms of others, and you have to have a bit more kind of boundaries and space for how's it going to work. Okay, so that's the questions this evening. And we can have a short break and come back for evening chanting of some sort.